psychiatric activities. The years at Berg Hultsley were my years of apprenticeship. Dominating my interests and research was the burning question, what actually takes place inside the mentally ill? That was something which I did not understand then, nor had any of my colleagues concerned themselves with such problems. Patients were labeled, rubber-stamped with a diagnosis, and for the most part, that settled the matter. At this point, Freud's work became vitally important to me, especially because of his fundamental researches into the psychology of hysteria and of dreams. For me, his ideas pointed the way to a closer investigation and understanding of individual cases. Freud introduced psychology into psychiatry, although he himself was a neurologist. I still recollect very well a case which greatly interested me at the time. A young woman had been admitted to the hospital suffering from melancholia. The examination was conducted with the usual care, case histories, tests, physical checkups, and so on. The diagnosis was schizophrenia, or dementia praecox, in the phrase of those days. The prognosis, poor. This woman happened to be in my section. At first, I did not dare to question the diagnosis. I was still a young man then, a beginner, and yet the case struck me as strange. I had the feeling that it was not a matter of schizophrenia, but of ordinary depression, and resolved to apply my own method. At the time, I was much occupied with diagnostic association studies, and so I undertook an association experiment with the patient. In addition, I discussed her dreams with her. In this way, I succeeded in uncovering her past, which the case history had not clarified. I obtained information directly from the unconscious, and this information revealed a dark and tragic story. Before the woman married, she had known a man, the son of a wealthy industrialist, in whom all the girls of the neighborhood were interested. Since she was very pretty, she thought her chances of catching him were fairly good. But apparently he did not care for her, and so she married another man. 5 years later, an old friend visited her. They were talking over old times, and he said to her, "When you got married, it was quite a shock to someone. Your Mr. X, the wealthy industrialist's son." That was the moment. Her depression dated from this period, and several weeks later led to a catastrophe. She was bathing her children, first her 4-year-old girl and then her 2-year-old son. She lived in a country where the water supply was not perfectly hygienic. There was pure spring water for drinking and tainted water from the river for bathing and washing. While she was bathing the little girl, she saw the child sucking at the sponge, but did not stop her. She even gave her little son a glass of the impure water to drink. Naturally, she did this unconsciously, or only half-consciously, for her mind was already under the shadow of the incipient depression. A short time later, after the incubation period had passed, the girl came down with typhoid fever and died. The girl had been her favorite. The boy was not infected. At that moment, the depression reached its acute stage, and the woman was sent to the institution. From the association test, I had seen that she was a murderess, and I had learned many of the details of her secret. It was at once apparent that this was a sufficient reason for her depression. Essentially, it was a psychogenic disturbance and not a case of schizophrenia. Now, what could be done in the way of therapy? Up to then, the woman had been given narcotics to combat her insomnia and had been under guard to prevent attempts at suicide. But otherwise, nothing had been done. Physically, she was in good condition. I was confronted with the problem. Should I speak openly with her or not? If I had asked my colleagues, they would probably have warned me, "For heaven's sake, don't tell the woman any such thing. That will only make her still crazier." Of course, I knew very well the personal risk I was running. If the patient got worse, I would be in the soup too. Nevertheless, I decided to take a chance on a therapy whose outcome was uncertain. I told her everything I had discovered through the association test. It can easily be imagined how difficult it was for me to do this. To accuse a person point-blank of murder is no small matter. And it was tragic for the patient to have to listen to it and accept it. But the result was that in 2 weeks it proved possible to discharge her, and she was never again institutionalized. There were other reasons that caused me to say nothing to my colleagues about this case. I was afraid of their discussing and possibly raising legal questions. Fate had punished her enough. It seemed to me more meaningful that she should return to life in order to atone in life for her crime. When she was discharged, she departed bearing her heavy burden. She had to bear this burden. The loss of the child had been frightful for her, and her expiation had already begun with the depression and her confinement to the institution. In many cases in psychiatry, the patient who comes to us has a story that is not told, and which, as a rule, no one knows of. To my mind, therapy only really begins after the investigation of the wholly personal story. It is the patient's secret, the rock against which he is shattered. If I know his secret story, I have a key to the treatment. The doctor's task is to find out how to gain that knowledge. In most cases, exploration of the conscious material is insufficient. Sometimes an association test can open the way. So can the interpretation of dreams, or long and patient human contact with the individual. In therapy, the problem is always the whole person, never the symptom alone. We must ask questions which challenge the whole personality. In my practice, I was constantly impressed by the way the human psyche reacts to a crime committed unconsciously. After all, that young woman was initially not aware that she had killed her child. And yet she had fallen into a condition that appeared to be the expression of extreme consciousness of guilt. I once had a similar case which I have never forgotten. A lady came into my office. She refused to give her name, said it did not matter, since she wished to have only the one consultation. It was apparent that she belonged to the upper levels of society. She had been a doctor, she said. What she had to communicate to me was a confession. Some 20 years ago, she had committed a murder out of jealousy. She had poisoned her best friend because she wanted to marry the friend's husband. She had thought that if the murder was not discovered, it would not disturb her. Moral considerations were of no importance to her, she thought. The consequences? She had in fact married the man, but he had died soon afterward, relatively young. During the following years, a number of strange things happened. The daughter of this marriage endeavored to get away from her as soon as she was grown up. She married young and vanished from view, drew further and further away, and ultimately the mother lost all contact with her. This lady was a passionate horsewoman, and owned several riding horses, of which she was extremely fond. One day, she discovered that the horses were beginning to grow nervous under her. Even her favorite shied and threw her. Finally, she had to give up riding. Thereafter, she clung to her dogs. She owned an unusually beautiful wolfhound, to which she was greatly attached. As chance would have it, this very dog was stricken with paralysis. With that, her cup was full. She felt that she was morally done for. She had to confess, and for this purpose she came to me. She was a murderess, but on top of that, she had also murdered herself. For one who commits such a crime destroys his own soul. The murderer has already passed sentence on himself. If someone has committed a crime and is caught, he suffers judicial punishment. If he has done it secretly, without moral consciousness of it, and remains undiscovered, the punishment can nevertheless be visited upon him, as our case shows. As a result of the murder, the woman was plunged into her unbearable loneliness. And in order to shake off this loneliness, she had made me share her knowledge. She had to have someone who was not a murderer to share the secret. She wanted to find a person who could accept her confession without prejudice, for by so doing, she would achieve once more something resembling a relationship to humanity. She had seen people and animals turn away from her and had been so struck by this silent verdict that she could not have endured further condemnation. I never found out who she was, nor do I have any proof that her story was true. Sometimes I have to ask myself what might have become of her, for that was by no means the end of her journey. Perhaps she was driven ultimately to suicide. I cannot imagine how she could have gone on living in that utter loneliness. Clinical diagnoses are important since they give the doctor a certain orientation, but they do not help the patient. The crucial thing is the story, for it alone shows the human background and the human suffering, and only at that point can the doctor's therapy begin to operate. Through my work with the patients, I realized that paranoid ideas and hallucinations contain a germ of meaning. A personality, a life history, a pattern of hopes and desires lie behind the psychosis. The fault is ours if we do not understand them. It dawned upon me then for the first time that a general psychology of the personality lies concealed within the psychosis, and that even here we come upon the old human conflicts. Although patients may appear dull and apathetic or totally imbecilic, there is more going on in their minds and more that is meaningful than there seems to be. At bottom, we discover nothing new and unknown in the mentally ill. Rather, we encounter the substratum of our own natures. Regarding them from the outside, all we see of the mentally ill is their tragic destruction, rarely the life of that side of the psyche which is turned away from us. Outward appearances are frequently deceptive, as I discovered to my astonishment in the case of a young catatonic patient. She was 18 years old and came from a cultivated family. At the age of 15, she had been seduced by her brother and abused by a schoolmate. From her 16th year on, she retreated into isolation. She concealed herself from people, and ultimately, the only emotional relationship left to her was one with a vicious watchdog which belonged to another family, and which she tried to win over. She grew steadily odder, and at 17 was taken to the mental hospital, where she spent a year and a half. She heard voices, refused food, and was completely mutistic. When I first saw her, she was in a typical catatonic state. In the course of many weeks, I succeeded, very gradually, in persuading her to speak. After overcoming many resistances, she told me that she had lived on the moon. The moon, it seemed, was inhabited, but at first she had seen only men. They had once taken her with them and deposited her in a sublunar dwelling where their children and wives were kept. For on a high mountain on the moon there lived a vampire who kidnapped and killed the women and children, so that the moon people were threatened with extinction. That was the reason for the sublunar existence of the feminine half of the population. My patient made up her mind to do something for the moon people and planned to destroy the vampire. After long preparations, she waited for the vampire on the platform of a tower which had been erected for this purpose. After a number of nights, she saw the monster approaching from afar, winging his way toward her like a great black bird. She took her long sacrificial knife, concealed it in her gown, and waited for the vampire's arrival. Suddenly, he stood before her. He had several pairs of wings. His face and entire figure were covered by them, so that she could see nothing but his feathers. Wonder struck, she was seized by curiosity to find out what he really looked like. She approached, hand on the knife. Suddenly the wings opened, and a man of unearthly beauty stood before her. He enclosed her in his winged arms with an iron grip, so that she could no longer wield the knife. In any case, she was so spellbound by the vampire's look that she would not have been capable of striking. He raised her from the platform and flew off with her. After this revelation, she was once again able to speak without inhibition, and now her resistances emerged. It seemed that I had stopped her return to the moon. She could no longer escape from the earth. This world was not beautiful, she said, but the moon was beautiful, and life there was rich in meaning. Sometime later, she suffered a relapse into her catatonia, and I had to have her taken to a sanatorium. For a while, she was violently insane. When she was discharged after some 2 months, it was once again possible to talk with her. Gradually, she came to see that life on Earth was unavoidable. Desperately, she fought against this conclusion and its consequences and had to be sent back to the sanatorium. Once I visited her in her cell and said to her, "All this won't do you any good. You cannot return to the moon." She took this in silence and with an appearance of utter apathy. This time, she was released after a short stay and resigned herself to her fate. For a while, she took a job as a nurse in a sanatorium. There was an assistant doctor there who made a somewhat rash approach to her. She responded with a revolver shot. Luckily, the man was only slightly wounded, but the incident revealed that she went about with a revolver all the time. Once before, she had turned up with a loaded gun. During the last interview, at the end of the treatment, she gave it to me. When I asked in amazement what she was doing with it, she replied, "I would have shot you down if you had failed me." When the excitement over the shooting had subsided, she returned to her native town. She married, had several children, and survived 2 world wars in the East without ever again suffering a relapse. What can be said by way of interpretation of these fantasies? As a result of the incest to which she had been subjected as a girl, she felt humiliated in the eyes of the world, but elevated in the realm of fantasy. She had been transported into a mythic realm, for incest is traditionally a prerogative of royalty and divinities. The consequence was complete alienation from the world, a state of psychosis. She became extra mundane, as it were, and lost contact with humanity. She plunged into cosmic distances, into outer space, where she met with the winged demon. As is the rule with such things, she projected his figure onto me during the treatment. Thus I was automatically threatened with death, as was everyone who might have persuaded her to return to normal human life. By telling me her story, she had in a sense betrayed the demon and attached herself to an earthly human being. Hence she was able to return to life and even to marry. Thereafter, I regarded the sufferings of the mentally ill in a different light, for I had gained insight into the richness and importance of their inner experience. I'm often asked about my psychotherapeutic or analytic method. I cannot reply unequivocally to the question. Therapy is different in every case. When a doctor tells me that he adheres strictly to this or that method, I have my doubts about his therapeutic effect. So much is said in the literature about the resistance of the patient that it would almost seem as if the doctor were trying to put something over on him, whereas the cure ought to grow naturally out of the patient himself. Psychotherapy and analysis are as varied as our human individuals. I treat every patient as individually as possible, because the solution of the problem is always an individual one. Universal rules can be postulated only with a grain of salt. A psychological truth is valid only if it can be reversed. A solution which would be out of the question for me may be just the right one for someone else. Naturally, a doctor must be familiar with the so-called methods, but he must guard against falling into any specific routine assumptions. In my analyses, they play no part. I am unsystematic very much by intention. To my mind, in dealing with individuals, only individual understanding will do. We need a different language for every patient. The crucial point is that I confront the patient as one human being to another. Analysis is a dialogue demanding two partners. Analyst and patient sit facing one another, eye to eye. The doctor has something to say, but so has the patient. Since the essence of psychotherapy is not the application of a method, psychiatric study alone does not suffice. I myself had to work for a long time before I possessed the equipment for psychotherapy. As early as 1909, I realized that I could not treat latent psychoses if I did not understand their symbolism. It was then I began to study mythology. As a doctor, I constantly have to ask myself what kind of message the patient is bringing me. What does he mean to me? If he means nothing, I have no point of attack. The doctor is effective only when he himself is affected. Only the wounded physician heals. It often happens that the patient is exactly the right plaster for the doctor's sore spot. I have frequently seen people become neurotic when they content themselves with inadequate or wrong answers to the questions of life. They seek position, marriage, reputation, outward success or money, and remain unhappy and neurotic even when they have attained what they were seeking. Such people are usually confined within too narrow a spiritual horizon. Their life has not sufficient content, sufficient meaning. If they are enabled to develop into more spacious personalities, the neurosis generally disappears. For that reason, the idea of development was always of the highest importance to me. The majority of my patients consisted not of believers, but of those who had lost their faith. The ones who came to me were the lost sheep. Even in this day and age, the believer has the opportunity in his church to live the symbolic life. We need only think of the experience of the Mass, of baptism, of the imitation of Christ, and many other aspects of religion. But to live and experience symbols presupposes a vital participation on the part of the believer, and only too often this is lacking in people today. In the neurotic, it is practically always lacking. In such cases, we have to observe whether the unconscious will not spontaneously bring up symbols to replace what is lacking. But then the question remains of whether a person who has symbolic dreams or visions will also be able to understand their meaning and take the consequences upon himself. Wherever there is a reaching down into innermost experience, into the nucleus of personality, most people are overcome by fright, and many run away. The risk of inner experience, the adventure of the spirit, is in any case alien to most human beings. The possibility that such experience might have a psychic reality is anathema to them. All very well if it has a supernatural, or at least a historical foundation. But psychic? Face to face with this question, the patient will often show an unsuspected but profound contempt for the psyche. Among the so-called neurotics of our day, there are a good many who in other ages would not have been neurotic, that is, divided against themselves. If they had lived in a period and a milieu in which man was still linked by myth with the world of the ancestors, and thus with nature truly experienced and not merely seen from outside, they would have been spared this division with themselves. These victims of the psychic dichotomy of our time are merely optional neurotics. Their apparent morbidity drops away the moment the gulf between the ego and the unconscious is closed. The doctor who has felt this dichotomy to the depths of his being will also be able to reach a better understanding of the unconscious psychic processes and will be saved from the danger of inflation to which the psychologist is prone. The doctor who does not know from his own experience the numinosity of the archetypes will scarcely be able to escape their negative effect when he encounters it in his practice. He will tend to over or underestimate it, since he possesses only an intellectual point of view, but no empirical criterion. This is where those perilous aberrations begin, the first of which is the attempt to dominate everything by the intellect. This serves the secret purpose of placing both doctor and patient at a safe distance from the archetypal effect, and thus from real experience, and of substituting for psychic reality an apparently secure, artificial, but merely two-dimensional conceptual world in which the reality of life is well covered up by so-called clear concepts. Experience is stripped of its substance, and instead mere names are substituted, which are henceforth put in place of reality. No one has any obligations to a concept. That is what is so agreeable about conceptuality. It promises protection from experience. The spirit does not dwell in concepts, but in deeds and in facts. Words butter no parsnips. Nevertheless, this futile procedure is repeated ad infinitum. In my experience, therefore, the most difficult, as well as the most ungrateful patients, apart from habitual liars, are the so-called intellectuals. With them, one hand never knows what the other hand is doing. They cultivate a compartment psychology. Anything can be settled by an intellect that is not subject to the control of feeling, and yet the intellectual still suffers from a neurosis if feeling is undeveloped. From my encounters with patients and with psychic phenomena, which they have paraded before me in an endless stream of images, I have learned an enormous amount, not just knowledge, but above all, insight into my own nature. And not the least of what I have learned has come from my errors and defeats. I have had mainly women patients, who often entered into the work with extraordinary conscientiousness, understanding, and intelligence. It was essentially because of them that I was able to strike out on new paths in therapy. A number of my patients became my disciples and have carried my ideas out into the world. Among them, I have made friendships that have endured decade after decade. My patients brought me so close to the reality of human life that I could not help learning essential things from them. Encounters with people of so many different kinds and on so many different levels have been for me incomparably more important than fragmentary conversations with celebrities. The finest and most significant conversations of my life were anonymous. Sigmund Freud. I embarked on the adventure of my intellectual development by becoming a psychiatrist. As early as 1900, I had read Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams. I had laid the book aside at the time because I did not yet grasp it. At the age of 25, I lacked the experience to appreciate Freud's theories. Such experience did not come until later. In 1903, I once more took up The Interpretation of Dreams and discovered how it all linked up with my own ideas. What chiefly interested me was the application to dreams of the concept of the repression mechanism, which was derived from the psychology of neuroses. This was important to me because I had frequently encountered repressions in my experiments with word association. In response to certain stimulus words, the patient either had no associative answer or was unduly slow in his reaction time. As was later discovered, such a disturbance occurred each time the stimulus word had touched upon a psychic lesion or conflict. In most cases, the patient was unconscious of this. When questioned about the cause of the disturbance, he would often answer in a peculiarly artificial manner. My reading of Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams showed me that the repression mechanism was at work here, and that the facts I had observed were consonant with his theory. Thus, I was able to corroborate Freud's line of argument. The situation was different when it came to the content of the repression. Here, I could not agree with Freud. He considered the cause of the repression to be a sexual trauma. From my practice, however, I was familiar with numerous cases of neurosis in which the question of sexuality played a subordinate part, other factors standing in the foreground, for example, the problem of social adaptation, of oppression by tragic circumstances of life, prestige considerations, and so on. Later, I presented such cases to Freud, but he would not grant that factors other than sexuality could be the cause. That was highly unsatisfactory to me. At the beginning, it was not easy for me to assign Freud the proper place in my life or to take the right attitude toward him. When I became acquainted with his work, I was planning an academic career and was about to complete a paper that was intended to advance me at the university. But Freud was definitely persona non grata in the academic world at the time, and any connection with him would have been damaging in scientific circles. Important people at most mentioned him surreptitiously, and at congresses he was discussed only in the corridors, never on the floor. Therefore, the discovery that my association experiments were in agreement with Freud's theories was far from pleasant to me. Once, while I was in my laboratory and reflecting again upon these questions, the devil whispered to me that I would be justified in publishing the results of my experiments and my conclusions without mentioning Freud. But then I heard the voice of my second personality. You cannot build your life upon a lie. With that, the question was settled. From then on, I became an open partisan of Freud's and fought for him. I first took up the cudgels for Freud at a congress in Munich, where a lecturer discussed obsessional neuroses, but studiously forbore to mention the name of Freud. In 1906, in connection with this incident, I wrote a paper on Freud's theory of the neurosis, which had contributed a great deal to the understanding of obsessional neuroses. In response to this article, two German professors wrote to me, warning that if I remained on Freud's side and continued to defend him, I would be endangering my academic career. I replied, "If what Freud says is the truth, I am with him. I don't give a damn for a career if it has to be based on the premise of restricting research and concealing truth." And I went on defending Freud and his ideas. But on the basis of my own findings, I was still unable to feel that all neuroses were caused by sexual repression or sexual trauma. In certain cases that was so, but not in others. Nevertheless, Freud had opened up a new path of investigation, and the shocked outcries against him at the time seemed to me absurd. I had not met with much sympathy for the ideas expressed in The Psychology of Dementia Praecox. In fact, my colleagues laughed at me. But through this book, I came to know Freud. He invited me to visit him, and our first meeting took place in Vienna in March 1907. We met at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and talked virtually without a pause for 13 hours. Freud was the first man of real importance I had encountered. In my experience up to that time, no one else could compare with him. There was nothing the least trivial in his attitude. I found him extremely intelligent, shrewd, and altogether remarkable. And yet my first impressions of him remained somewhat tangled. I could not make him out. Above all, Freud's attitude toward the spirit seemed to me highly questionable. Wherever, in a person or in a work of art, an expression of spirituality came to light, he suspected it, and insinuated that it was repressed sexuality. Anything that could not be directly interpreted as sexuality, he referred to as psychosexuality. I protested that this hypothesis, carried to its logical conclusion, would lead to an annihilating judgment upon culture. Culture would then appear as a mere farce, the morbid consequence of repressed sexuality. Yes, he assented, so it is. And that is just a curse of fate against which we are powerless to contend. I was by no means disposed to agree, or to let it go at that, but still I did not feel competent to argue it out with him. I can still recall vividly how Freud said to me, "My dear Jung, promise me never to abandon the sexual theory. That is the most essential thing of all. You see, we must make a dogma of it, an unshakable bulwark." He said that to me with great emotion, in the tone of a father saying, "And promise me this one thing, my dear son, that you will go to church every Sunday." In some astonishment, I asked him, "A bulwark? Against what?" To which he replied, "Against the black tide of mud." And here he hesitated a moment, then added, "Of occultism." First of all, it was the words bulwark and dogma that alarmed me. For a dogma, that is to say, an undisputable confession of faith, is set up only when the aim is to suppress doubts once and for all, But that no longer has anything to do with scientific judgment, only with a personal power drive. This was the thing that struck at the heart of our friendship. I knew I would never be able to accept such an attitude. Although I did not properly understand it then, I had observed in Freud the eruption of unconscious religious factors. Evidently, he wanted my aid in erecting a barrier against these threatening unconscious contents. I was bewildered and embarrassed. I had the feeling that I had caught a glimpse of a new, unknown country from which swarms of new ideas flew to meet me. One thing was clear. Freud, who had always made much of his irreligiosity, had now constructed a dogma, or rather, in the place of a jealous god whom he had lost, he had substituted another compelling image, that of sexuality. It was no less insistent, exacting, domineering, threatening, and morally ambivalent than the original one. Just as the psychically stronger agency is given divine or demonic attributes, so the sexual libido took over the role of a hidden or concealed god. The advantage of this transformation for Freud was, apparently, that he was able to regard the new numinous principle as scientifically irreproachable and free from all religious taint. At bottom, however, the numinosity, that is, the psychological qualities of the two rationally incommensurable opposites, Yahweh and sexuality, remained the same. The name alone had changed, and with it, of course, the point of view. The lost god had now to be sought below, not above. Like flames suddenly flaring up, these thoughts darted through my mind. Much later, when I reflected upon Freud's character, they revealed their significance. There was one characteristic of his that preoccupied me above all: his bitterness. Freud never asked himself why he was compelled to talk continually of sex, why this idea had taken such possession of him. He remained unaware that his monotony of interpretation expressed a flight from himself, or from that other side of him which might perhaps be called mystical. So long as he refused to acknowledge that side, he could never be reconciled with himself. He was blind toward the paradox and ambiguity of the contents of the unconscious, and did not know that everything which arises out of the unconscious has a top and a bottom, an inside and an outside. When we speak of the outside, and that is what Freud did, we are considering only half of the whole, with the result that a counter-effect arises out of the unconscious. There was nothing to be done about this one-sidedness of Freud's. Perhaps some inner experience of his own might have opened his eyes, but then his intellect would have reduced such experience to mere sexuality or psychosexuality. He remained the victim of the one aspect he could recognize, and for that reason I see him as a tragic figure, for he was a great man, and what is more, a man in the grip of his demon. The year 1909 proved decisive for our relationship. I had been invited to lecture on the association experiment at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Independently, Freud had also received an invitation, and we decided to travel together. We met in Bremen, where Ferenczi joined us. In Bremen, the much-discussed incident of Freud's fainting fit occurred. It was provoked, indirectly, by my interest in the peat bog corpses. I knew that in certain districts of northern Germany, these so-called bog corpses were to be found. They are the bodies of prehistoric men who either drowned in the marshes or were buried there. The bog water in which the bodies lie contains humic acid, which consumes the bones and simultaneously tans the skin, so that it and the hair are perfectly preserved. In essence, this is the process of natural mummification. This interest of mine got on Freud's nerves. "Why are you so concerned with these corpses?" he asked me several times. He was inordinately vexed by the whole thing, and during one such conversation, while we were having dinner together, he suddenly fainted. Afterward, he said to me that he was convinced that all this chatter about corpses meant I had death wishes toward him. I was more than surprised by this interpretation. I was alarmed by the intensity of his fantasies, so strong that obviously they could cause him to faint. In a similar connection, Freud once more suffered a fainting fit in my presence. This was during the Psychoanalytic Congress in Munich in 1912. Someone had turned the conversation to the Egyptian king Akhenaten. The point was made that, as a result of his negative attitude toward his father, he had destroyed his father's cartouches on the steles, and that at the back of his great creation of monotheistic religion, there lurked a father complex. At that moment, Freud slid off his chair in a faint. Everyone clustered helplessly around him. I picked him up, carried him into the next room, and laid him on a sofa. As I was carrying him, he half came to, and I shall never forget the look he cast at me. In his weakness, he looked at me as if I were his father. Whatever other causes may have contributed to this faint, the atmosphere was very tense. The fantasy of father murder was common to both cases.